Hello, and welcome to a special supplementary edition of Exiting the Cave Short Reads. As you may be aware, we've been working our way through Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy, and we've reached the apex of our discussion, contemplating the unity of goodness, happiness, and God. There is no Boethius reading for this podcast. Instead, I thought it might be helpful to take a momentary step back before we proceed to the next episode, in order to remind ourselves of what Boethius is trying to accomplish. The process of consolation for Boethius is not merely comfort or relief from his worldly anxiety. Rather, it is the tranquility that comes from the wisdom to see himself as he fits into the greater order of the universe. In other words, to gain just enough of an understanding of God's plan that he can see how he fits within it. In so doing, he can reconcile himself to his own fate. It is Lady Philosophy's task to guide Boethius to that wisdom. We have not spoken much about who she is. In this podcast, I'd like to explore one likely possibility. As we know, Boethius was a Roman Christian in the Augustinian Neoplatonic tradition. Though he avoids explicitly Christian language in the text, hints of his belief are everywhere. In Book 3, Chapter 12, Boethius is going to deploy a key phrase from the Old Testament Book of Wisdom. This is an extremely important tell on Boethius's part. He's clearly signaling to his Roman Christian readers that he has not forgotten his Christian identity. But more importantly, Boethius is putting into the mouth of Lady Philosophy a phrase that actually belongs to the first biblical depiction of wisdom personified as a woman. Lady Philosophy says, roughly, depending on your translation, "It is the highest good that rules all things strongly and disposes them sweetly." Wisdom 8:1 says this: "Wisdom reaches to the ends of the earth and mightily orders all things according to the good." Again, depending on your translation. I think this gives us a very strong clue as to with whom Boethius thinks he is engaged in dialogue. Lady Philosophy, on my theory, is wisdom personified. And who is that? It is tempting to identify her with the Logos, famously depicted in the opening passages of John, but I'm not sure this is quite right. Rather, I think she is an active spirit, an expression of the Logos, capable of having an effect in creation. At the risk of waxing heretical, the aspect of the Holy Spirit that joins the Word to the world. To argue my case, I'm actually going to give you a reading, but not from Boethius. Instead, what you're about to hear is an assemblage of passages from Wisdom chapter 7, Proverbs chapter 8, and Wisdom chapter 8. They present a vivid outline of the nature of wisdom personified and describe Solomon's relationship to her. I think once you hear these passages, it will be more than abundantly clear who Boethius had in mind when he decided to write the Consolation. We begin with Solomon describing wisdom to us in Wisdom 7, verses 21 through 26.
"Whatever is hidden or manifest, I have learned, because wisdom, artisan of all things, taught me. For in her is a spirit intelligent, holy, unique, manifold, subtle, certain, agile, unpolluted, beneficent, loving and good, keen, invulnerable, irresistible, steadfast, secure, tranquil, omniscient and omnipotent. She penetrates and pervades all spirits that are intelligent, pure, and subtle. For wisdom is mobile beyond all motion. She penetrates and pervades all things by reason of her purity. She is a breath of the power of God, and a pure emanation of the glory of the Almighty. Therefore, nothing defiled can enter into her. For she is a reflection of the eternal light, the spotless mirror of the work of God, an image of his goodness.
The similarities between this personification and Lady Philosophy's language in these later chapters are quite striking. The intelligent spirit that penetrates and pervades all intelligent spirits and the spotless reflection of the eternal light both evoke the radiance that Boethius described in the first book of the Consolation. But there is a more important feature of wisdom personified that lends itself to the analysis we've been working on in chapters 9 and 10 of Book 3 of the Consolation. Namely, this passage hints at the identification of wisdom with God himself. All of the attributes the Book of Wisdom ascribes to this personification could just as well apply directly to God. I don't think that's an accident. But to drive the point home, let's have a look at a passage from Proverbs, chapter 8, verses 1 through 10, wherein the personified woman Wisdom describes her own origin.
Does not wisdom call by the gates at the approach of the city? At the portal she cries aloud. To you, O people, I call. My cry is to the living. O simple ones, learn prudence. You fools, seek ye knowledge. Hark, for I speak of noble things. From my lips I proclaim honest words. From my mouth is uttered the truth. For wickedness and abomination is alien to me. All my words are true and just, nothing in them twisted or wily. To the one who understands, they are straight. And write to those who attain knowledge. Take my instruction instead of silver, and knowledge rather than choice gold. The Lord begot me at the beginning of his work, the first of his acts long ago. From the old I was formed, at the first, before the formation of the earth. When there were no depths, I was brought forth. When there were no fountains or springs of water, before the mountains were raised into place, before the hills, I was brought forth. When he established the heavens, there was I. When he marked out the vault over the face of the deep, when he made firm the skies above, when he fixed the springs of the deep, when he assigned to the sea its limit so that the waters should not transgress his command, when he fixed the foundations of the earth, then was I beside him as a master artisan. I was his delight each day, rejoicing before him all the while, rejoicing in the whole of his inhabited world, and delighting especially in mankind. Now, children, listen to me. Happy are those who keep my ways. Listen to instruction and grow wise. Do not neglect or reject it. Happy is the one who listens to me, attending daily to my gates, keeping watch at my door. For whoever finds me finds life and wins favor from the Lord. But those who pass me by do themselves great harm. All who hate me love death. So, like Lady Philosophy, the personified woman Wisdom is offering the gift of knowledge to those willing to listen and learn. But she is also something a bit more, an aspect of God's divine mind itself made manifest at the time of creation. Christians, particularly Catholics, typically associate Christ with the Logos, the Word made flesh. Perhaps personified woman Wisdom is the Word made spirit, in which case she's a very close match for Lady Philosophy. This would also round out the triad of spirit, mind, and flesh, typically associated with living things in Boethius's Theodicy. But the story doesn't end there. Recall that Boethius has a long-standing relationship with Lady Philosophy, stretching back to his youth.
His depictions of this in Book 1 and 2 of the Consolation are remarkably reminiscent of the subsequent passage in Chapter 8 of the Book of Wisdom. Listen to Solomon here in verses 1 through 21 describing his relationship to the personified woman Wisdom, and see for yourself if it's not a parallel of Boethius' life.
Indeed, she reaches to the ends of the earth mightily, and orders all things according to the good. Her I loved and sought after since I was a boy. I sought to take her for my bride, and fell in love with her beauty. She glorifies her nobility by the splendor of companionship with the ruler of all who loves her. For she is the initiate into the understanding of God, choosing the works to be done. If riches are to be desired, what is richer than wisdom, the active cause of all things? If understanding is what gives purchase, where is there a greater artisan than she, the designer of all? If one loves righteousness, her works are the virtues, for she teaches temperance, prudence, justice, and courage. Or, if one longs for wide experience, she knows the things of old, and divines the things to come. She understands the maxims, and solves the riddles. Signs and wonders she foretells, and the unfolding of the seasons and the ages. Therefore, I determined to take her to live with me, knowing she would offer me good counsel and consolation in my griefs and cares. Because of her, I believed I would have glory among the multitudes, and honor in the presence of the elders. Though I am but a youth, I shall become keen in my judgment, and shall be admired by rulers. Because of her, I shall have immortality, and leave to those after me an everlasting memory. In my home, I shall take repose with her, for nothing is bitter in her company. Living with her is no grief, only joy. Reflecting on these things and pondering in my heart that immortality lies in kinship with wisdom, and in friendship with her is pure delight, and unfailing wealth in the labor of her hands, and in her company is to be found prudence and fair renown in sharing her discourses, I went about seeking to take her for my own. As a child I was favored, and a good soul fell to my lot. Or rather, being noble, I entered a body undefiled. And knowing that I could not otherwise possess her except as a gift from God, this too a mark of insight, to know whose gift she is to give, I turned to the Lord.
So in this passage, we get a direct identification between the properties and powers of God and the properties and powers of the personified wisdom. But we see a Solomon whose longings led him to her in much the same way they led Boethius to lady philosophy. We also saw hints of Solomon's own temptations to riches, renown, and glory, things Boethius and lady philosophy have refuted at length by this point in the story. So it doesn't seem beyond the pale to me to suggest that the books of Proverbs and Wisdom were touch points for Boethius in the creation of the Consolation. According to my Catholic study Bible, the references to the cardinal virtues in this passage were indeed call-outs to Platonic philosophy. The writers of the books of Proverbs and Wisdom were indeed apparently familiar with pre-Christian Neoplatonism, at least to the extent that they could name the cardinal virtues. They were also familiar with Stoicism, and may have employed elements of it in their understanding of wisdom. Here's what Diane Bergant, the author of the section on wisdom, had to say about it. The actual description of wisdom is composed of elements from Israelite tradition, from the cult of the Egyptian deity Isis, goddess of wisdom and patron of a culture whose praises were extolled similarly to that found in Wisdom 7:22, and Hellenistic philosophy and science, see mention of the cardinal virtues found in Plato.
The section may well be at the heart of the author's argument in favor of the superiority of the religion of Israel. The author confers characteristics of Isis on the figure of wisdom that are already found in the Israelite tradition, and draws upon Hellenistic religious and scientific concepts to praise her, as he argues that real wisdom is a gift from God bestowed on the faithful. Earlier traditions spoke of a spirit of wisdom, but here wisdom itself is called a spirit. The author brought two quite distinct and dissimilar concepts together by merging the notion of intelligence, the basic meaning of wisdom, with that of energy or power, the central idea in spirit. Having done this, he could then speak of the wisdom spirit as a breath of the might of God. Although spirit played a major role in Stoic philosophy, it was clearly a prominent theme in Jewish tradition as well. In his description of the nature and dignity of wisdom, 7:22-24, the author may have employed attributes of the world spirit, a concept in Stoic philosophy. However, when he recounted the early history of Israel, he equated wisdom with the spirit of the Lord. The figure of personified wisdom was reinterpreted by early Christian theologians as they struggled to understand Jesus the Christ. Paul explicitly referred to Christ as the wisdom of God. However, the most obvious example of this reinterpretation is found in the Gospel according to John, where we find Jesus described in ways that wisdom had been depicted earlier, as being with God in the beginning before the world existed, as sent from heaven to accomplish the will of God.
If what Diane is saying is so, then it's also possible that Boethius was, at least in some sense, trying to leave some subtle breadcrumbs that would lead the attentive Christian reader from the superficial symbols of Neoplatonic and Neo-Pagan philosophy straight back to Christ himself. Not being a theologian, all I can do is leave you with these speculations and tantalizing questions. One broader point to bring up in closing, however, would be to point out the tectonic depth and breadth of the influences of both Jerusalem and Athens on Western culture in general. Many times I've pointed out the influence that Boethius has had on subsequent thinkers. But if what I've been saying in this podcast is correct, then Boethius himself was merely a conduit for a powerful pipeline of religious and intellectual values stretching back several thousand years before he was even born. The contemplation of this is breathtaking and disorienting to me. The degree of responsibility on our shoulders is immense. The implications of our modern attitude toward this tradition and our political actions deriving from that attitude are frankly terrifying. What immense storehouse of self-knowledge and wisdom are we cutting ourselves loose from in the name of technological hubris? How much destruction are we going to wreak upon ourselves in abandoning this awareness of our collective past? I've never been much for speaking in terms of collective anything, but even an Enlightenment liberal would concede that the ideological stew we swim in today is largely a product of 3,000 years of religious and intellectual effort painstakingly reproduced for generations, and that there's no telling the disaster we face in setting all of that ablaze now in the name of forward progress and social justice. In any case, I don't want to drift too far afield here or leave on too depressing a note, so I'll just let you off the bus here and catch you at the next episode of Short Reads. Till then, bye-bye.